Hello and welcome to End Credits here on CFRU 93.3 FM, CFRU.ca, Guelph Campus and Community Radio. I'm your host, Adam A. Donaldson, and joining me a bit later will be Candace Lepage as we start our lockdown version of the show proper. Last week we did the What We've Been Watching show where we had everybody on to take a turn to talk about some of the stuff they've been watching, in many cases alone in their homes. And this week we're going to kick off the new, hopefully temporary format where we're going to do a big review in the back half of the show. And then for the first half, we're going to have some discussion about, well, this week it's going to be about all the changes to movie release dates that have been happening as movie theaters have become non-essential services, sadly, as we deal with COVID-19. End Credits is a local movie show for local movie fans. We are here every Wednesday at 2 p.m. to talk the latest in pop culture and review the newest movies, which this week will be the new young romantic drama, All the Bright Places, and that is currently streaming on Netflix, and Candace will be joining us to do that review. As I said, though, we are going to start off with talking about all the movies that have had to move off their release dates as the virus has been spreading. It has not been all bad news necessarily. As you may have noticed, if you've been going to the Apple Store or Google Play or YouTube or wherever you rent movies from, there have been a number of recent movies that have already been released on home video or video on demand, I guess depending on depending on where you what time you grew up in. So movies like Onward, Birds of Prey, The Invisible Man, Bloodshot, The Hunt, The Way Back, these have all sort of come out in the last month or so and are now available for you to download at home. Like some, like The Invisible Man, you do have to pay $19.99 for. But you know, if you really think about it, that's maybe $5 more than the price of a 3D movie ticket. So that's not all bad. I do, though, understand how that could be cost prohibitive to the cheap movie viewer, shall we say. Another interesting note is that Trolls World Tour, which is a sequel to the animated movie Trolls, which came out a few years ago, it is being released on VOD this coming weekend. It was supposed to come out in theaters this coming weekend, of course, because theaters are closed. Universal Pictures made the decision to just release it direct to DVD, or excuse me, direct to VOD, again, showing my age there. But that is an option for some. It is going to be less an option for other things. Like, think about your really big movies, like the ones that will be coming out in the next couple of weeks, the next couple of months, like Black Widow or Wonder Woman 1984 or The Fast and the Furious 9. These are movies that need the global box office to make themselves economically viable, and if there's no global box office, they're not necessarily economically viable. So I'm going to start with the big one, with big one studio-wise speaking, which is Disney. And they've made some very interesting moves in some cases. In some cases, like if you've been following how Disney's operated in the last few years, what they've done is they've sort of blocked off release dates for like 5 years in advance. So even if they may not have a specific project for like a weekend in May in 2022, they will block that off and say untitled Disney project or untitled Marvel project or untitled Pixar project, and they will plant a flag on that weekend, usually in an effort to sort of scare away any other studio that might be looking to these future weekends for their own tentpole releases. The biggest, weirdest, boldest move Disney has made so far is they have taken this film called Artemis Fowl, which is a very popular book series, I must admit. I have not read it myself, but I do know that Artemis Fowl does have a lot of fans. So this was theoretically going to be a big movie for the studio, but instead it will now be released. It was supposed to come out the last weekend in May, but now it's going to come out on Disney Plus in August. Actually, no, I'm lying. It hasn't been disclosed when exactly it'll be released yet. It was supposed to come out in August 2019, but then they moved it back to May 2020, and now it's going to go straight to Disney Plus, which is, I mean, it's both not unexpected, but also kind of an admission of defeat on Disney's part. I mean, this was always a movie. I mean, this is a movie that's been in development for about 20 years. It's gone, one of those movies that's gone through several directors and several writers. Kenneth Branagh was the one who was finally able to make it a film. And I think Disney had some kind of hope that, because Artemis Fowl is a big book series, that they could turn it into a franchise. And I think shunting it directly to Disney Plus is that admission of defeat, that it is not going to be the franchise that Disney was hoping it would be. Certainly not like Marvel. Marvel is sort of like the beneficiary of all this Disney advance planning, because Black Widow was supposed to come out the first weekend in May. Now it's been moved to the first weekend in November. That was the weekend that The Eternals was supposed to come out, which is from Chloe Zhao, based on sort of these long-lived cosmic characters in the Marvel Universe. Now that movie has been pushed back to February the 12th, which was supposed to be the release date of Shang-Chi, Legend of the Ten Rings. I'm not sure where I got 12 rings from. You only have 10 fingers. But Shang-Chi will now move till May 7th, 2021, which was the original home of Doctor Strange. Doctor Strange 2, The Multiverse of Madness. Now that movie will come out November 5th, which was the original release date for the fourth Thor movie, which is called Love and Thunder, and that will come out in February 18, 2022. So you have the Disney kind of coping very well with just maybe just asking all the Marvel movies to move one place down. Shang-Chi was in principal photography. They had to call an end to that because of the COVID-19 pandemic. Moving closer to Christmas time, it seems like things are kind of stable there. You have Top Gun Maverick, which, as implied, is a sequel to Top Gun. It was supposed to come out in June. It has been pushed back to December 23rd, which kind of puts it right in the middle of these two big movies that were still scheduled for Christmas. One is the West Side Story remake from Steven Spielberg. It's still coming out on December 18th. And Ridley Scott's The Last Duel, which is a new script from Matt Damon and Ben Affleck, actually. And they're both in the film. That is still coming out on December 25th. I'm just looking down the list of other things here. Quiet Place 2 is supposed to come out last month. It is now coming out on September the 4th, which is the same weekend as Monster Hunter, which is a video game-based movie starring Mila Jovovich, directed by her husband, Paul W.S. Anderson. It's a Resident Evil reunion, although I guess they don't really reunite since they presumably have a home together. So that's going to be a very interesting weekend, because that's the weekend before Labor Day, which is typically sort of like the last gasp of summer, where like there's usually like kind of no major releases that weekend. So it's kind of weird that you're getting Quiet Place 2, for which there's very high expectations, but you also have Monster Hunter, for which there's expectations that perhaps it will do good business. Be another sort of franchise from the Anderson-Jovovich faculty. There are a couple of movies that have not moved from their summer spot yet. Wonder Woman 1984, for instance, before I get to the ones that haven't moved, Wonder Woman 1984 has moved. It was supposed to open in June. It's now opening August 14th. You have this weird situation where it seems like everyone has sort of moved to the end of July. That seems to be like the quote-unquote official launch of summer now. Mulan, which was supposed to come out a couple of weekends ago, which is the live-action remake of the Disney film, it has moved to July 24th. But still, in its original slots, you have, on June 19th, you have The King of Staten Island, which is the new film from Judd Apatow, and, it stars Pete Davidson, along with Judd Apatow's daughter. They play a brother and sister. That is still released, or still scheduled to come out on June 19th, and so is Soul on that same weekend, which is the next Pixar Disney animated film. So, as I'm kind of recording this Monday night, there's no news if they have a moved spot. The biggest one, of course, over all those, is Tenet, the next Christopher Nolan movie, which is still scheduled to come out July 17th, and perhaps it's far enough out that people are thinking that, you know, maybe the COVID situation will be chilled out by then. Who can say? Maybe that's wishful thinking, but you never know. You know, there are some smaller films to think about, too. The Lovebirds, which stars Issa Rae and Kumail Nanjiani. It's from Michael Showalter, who did The Big Sick. That was supposed to come out last weekend. It is to be determined when that will come out now. There has been some rumors that Netflix might pick it up, which would not be terribly surprising. It might be perhaps the best thing that could happen to that movie, and, you know, make it lost in the glut once the movie theaters open up again. Who can say? The French Dispatch, which was going to come out in July, right in the middle of summer, which is an unusual move for a Wes Anderson movie. It's now been pushed back to October 16th. I think the last time a Wes Anderson movie opened in the fall, I think it was The Fantastic Mr. Fox, almost, I want to say 12 years ago. I'm just checking my time here, because I do have to watch my time, because I do have to get to our review, which I have recorded before this segment, which may be unwise. But I'm going to run down some of the others here. I'm just looking at the IGN site, and they have a gallery of films that have had to shift their release date. One of the ones that went, like, really off, like, you know, to take a big break before having to come out again, is the Fast and Furious 9. It was supposed to come out at the end of May, and it was now coming out in April 2021. Of course, we talked on the show about the next James Bond movie, No Time to Die. It was supposed to come out, I think, next weekend. Now it will come out November 12th in the UK and November 25th in North America. That's not unusual. The UK usually gets first crack at James Bond, considering he's their resident spy. As I said, Mulan is coming out July 24th. Quiet Place on September 4th. The New Mutants. New Mutants has actually been in the can for about 3 years. It's like the last of the old Fox regime X-Men movies. A lot of people have been seriously floating the idea that it was gonna end up in Disney Plus all along. And I think that's probably gonna come to fruition. It's had three release dates. It's been tinkered with and reshot. There's a real question about what condition this film is in, and how it meets the original vision of the director. And it's the last Fox movie featuring the sort of the Fox iteration of X-Men, so Disney may not feel too terribly beholden to release that. Give it the theatrical release, or the theatrical release that they thought they were going to. Spiral, which is this weird Chris Rock entry in the Saw franchise. I was really looking forward to this, but it has been moved from its May 15th release. No new release date has been set yet. May I suggest Halloween? Halloween was the traditional release date for the Saw movies. Minions: The Rise of Gru. I'm not a Minions fan myself, but I'm also not 6 years old. It was supposed to come out in July. No new release date has been established for it yet. Wonder Woman 1984 is coming out on August 14th, as I said. Top Gun on Christmas Eve. In the Heights, which is an adaptation of another Lin-Manuel Miranda musical. It will be, it was supposed to come out on June 26th, but no new release date has been set for that one yet. Scoob, which is a new animated Scooby-Doo movie. There has been no new date set for that one yet. Nor has there been, or actually, The Malignant, which is the next James Wan movie. It is still currently scheduled for release on its August date. I'm thinking that probably might likely hold its place, but we will see. Ghostbusters Afterlife is another big one. It was supposed to come out in July. Now it's coming out in March 5th. Morbius, which is a Spider-Man character that Sony has the rights to, and you know they're making movies out of these characters because they can. It was supposed to come out on July 31st. It will now come out next March as well. And I'll wrap up with this bit. Uncharted, which is based on the popular video game series. This is another one of those movies that has had several different directors and has had several different stars attached. This time it's Tom Holland of Spider-Man fame who's attached to it. The release date has been moved from March 5th, 2021 to October 8th, 2021. I don't care how far back they move these release dates. We are never going to see an Uncharted movie. I would practically guarantee it. Nothing surprises me anymore, but I find it highly suspect we will see an Uncharted movie in 2021. And with that, I am going to call a break and get the musical selection of the week queued up here, and then we'll come right back with a full review of All the Bright Places. You are listening to End Credits here on CFRU 93.3 FM, CFRU.ca, Guelph Campus, and Community Radio.
From me.
I was just thinking that we should be partners for the Wandering Project. I think it would be good for you to get out.
Maybe I don't want to get out. Maybe I'm sick of people.
Yeah, people are stupid. But the tiniest few might actually mean well.
Why do you want to do this with me anyway?
Because there are places that need to be seen. Maybe even the smallest of places can mean something. At the very least, maybe they can mean something to us.
Not in us.
Maybe they can mean something to you and me. Jesus. Come here, there's a joke. Two wanders. That's all. We can do more if you end up loving it.
I won't.
You might.
No, I won't.
And that was a clip from All the Bright Places. It's the new film from Brett Haley, and it stars Elle Fanning, Justice Smith, Alexandra Shipp, Keegan-Michael Key, Kelly O'Hara, and Luke Wilson. Now joining me on the telephonic computer device, sort of, is Candace LaPage. Candace, how are you today?
I'm good. I'm glad to join you on the
telephonic computer device. It's really making all this craziness just so much better.
Yes. Well, we are very, very lucky to have so much technology in a time like we're going through right now, so that
imagine we can all having stay in touch to like this, do this so. Show just by yelling at each other through an open window. That would be tin cans. You know
tin
what?
Cans.
That did work. The tin can and the string. I had to make those in back in Cubs. I think we did it, and it is surprising. I was going to say surprisingly effective. It's not surprisingly effective at all. It's actually quite ineffective. But it is interesting, and it can be done, and it does work. I wouldn't want to do a radio show with it, but there you go.
Yeah, we'd have to distribute a lot of cans
you know what?
To
that
other
may
people
be the,
so they
the
could hear
economic
us.
Solution we're looking for is hiring people to poke holes in cans, tie strings to them, and then run a network across town.
Yep. Any job is a good
all right.
job. I'm here.
Now that we've solved the nation's economic troubles, we're going to talk about All the Bright Things, which was which is on Netflix, of course. People can go and if they are listening to this live, maybe if you haven't seen the movie yet, go check out the movie and then come back and listen to the podcast version. Or perhaps you have checked out the movie because you don't have anything else to do but go through your list on Netflix. But this was your pick. You wanted to review All the Bright Places, so I'll let you explain why All the Bright Places appealed to you, aside from the title, the title, All the Bright Places. It's a bit of a trap, but you know, it's theoretically appealing in these uncertain times. Like, I want to watch something called All the Bright Places.
Yeah. So I suspect that other people who are just, you know, scrolling through their Netflix might not accidentally come up on this one because it might not be in their, like, best matches for Candace area, which is where I found it. Because I did very little looking into it. I just scrolled through that list for new stuff and saw this and clicked on it, and it said drama, teenage, and dark, it said. And I thought, perfect, teenage melodrama. That's what I love. Which this certainly is. It just fell into the algorithm of what Candace likes to watch. We very rarely seem to cover much in the way of teenage, movies, though I was the one who wanted to do The Boy Who Would Be King and trying to think of all the other youngish movies that I have decided to cover for this show, because that's one of my kryptonites.
It's interesting
is the teenage
to
melodrama
say that, because I think Netflix is where all these movies have gone. They don't get the big theatrical release anymore. It's, you know, Netflix has also done To All the Boys I've Loved Before, which I think is the title of that film. It just seems
which
like
I loved
because I guess maybe they're also very, let's say, economic to make. You know, you get a cast of young people, mostly unknown. You're shooting in all the Bright Places shot in Cleveland, although it's set in Indiana. It's fairly economic, and you know, the economics of these movies, it's actually more expensive to release them on 3,000 screens than it is to produce them, so it just makes better sense to go on Netflix, and you know, I think that's why they sort of miss our they miss our show until it comes to a situation where we can't go to the movies and we have to look for things on Netflix.
Yeah, and you know, these are also movies that are typically made out of a young adult novel. So I feel like that's probably part of the economics of it as well, that, you know, you're already, there's already an audience and there's already a story. So it's just, you know, hire someone who is able to make a script out of that. And so far, from what I hear from sort of reviews and Tumblr, which I do spend a lot of time on Tumblr, where all the other young adult teenage melodrama fans spend time. Netflix is really doing a great job with these types of movies. I mean, I've enjoyed all the ones I've watched, but it looks like the fan base does as well. So,
I mean, this is not necessarily my wheelhouse, but I did note that Jennifer Niven, who wrote the original novel, was also involved in this. She co-wrote the screenplay. So it seems that whoever's in charge over at Netflix has sort of taken the approach that these things be sort of lovingly adapted, and at least handed off to people who might have an appreciation for the material. And I mean, I'm one of these skeptics of, you know, when sort of the original author gets involved in adapting their material, you know, can, you know, it's. I think we've seen it a lot with the Harry Potter movies. I think J.K. Rowling was probably too close to those adaptations to sort of let them be their own thing. But it does seem to be maybe working out for the best here, where the focus really is character and interaction. And, you know, if you really want to get into the head spaces of those characters, it's probably best to have the person who originated those characters involved in some creative capacity, I guess.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And I understand. So Elle Fanning plays the lead character. And I understand that the author Jennifer Niven actually sort of, that was kind of her mm-hmm. primary push to begin with. And, you know, who knows how much Jennifer Niven was part of sort of creating everything. But I think that sort of piece, that sort of detail where you can say, you know, I think this actor can really embody the feel that I was writing, really helps those characters like come to life, and also come to life probably for the fans. Also, you can't beat Elle Fanning. I mean, I don't think I've ever seen her do a bad performance.
She was one of the producers of the film too. So, what it says to me is probably the book and the character of Violet spoke to her in a very, maybe not profound way, but something attracted to her to the part that you know, maybe spoke to her in a way that went above and beyond how, and, you know, anytime an actor is cast in a part, she obviously felt a deeper connection to, I guess, maybe have a bit more creative involvement in how the film was developed.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And I certainly note and recognize that neither of us have really talked about the content of the film yet. Because the content, despite the title, All the Bright Places, it is really, it certainly falls more into the melodrama category of teenage melodrama, and not in the cheesy soap opera way, but in the really, really challenging way that I think is really important to tell stories like this and to tell them so honestly. So, you know, just reading sort of the breakdown of it, you quickly learn that it's, you know, two teenagers who, I mean, it's a love story, and it's also explained, you know, just in the write-up that they're both, a little
different.
they're working different. Through things. Yeah. They're both working through their own sort of personal tragedies and mental health issues, and you know, that's a real reality of a lot of people and a lot of teenagers. And I think they did a really nice job of not going really over the top with it. You know, like I will talk about how much love the OC and like some straight up soap opera, like. They just play up the Marissa and all of her mental health issues to like this maximum that just makes it.
It hits a false note, because, you know, I remember, I think it's season 2 of the OC that opens with Marissa's mom asking her what's wrong, and Misha Barton just like screams for 5 minutes. Right. Yeah.
Yeah, and like throws things into the pool.
Yes.
And,
yeah. It's basically it wasn't subtle.
Yeah.
The OC. Not still love it. Still, you know, it still had its moments, but yeah, this is, there's something much more grounded about this. And I made note of that, you know, you see, I think the two probably best known actors in it are Elle Fanning and Justice Smith, who plays, Finch, who is her love interest. Most of the other high school characters, seem to be unknowns, and, they, I would say don't come out of central casting when you think of some, you know, when you think of high school shows and movies that you see in, most of the time on TV or at the theaters. They, really do have a, I was going to say a more teenage feeling, but, I think people might understand what I mean by that. They don't seem to come out of, you know, the very, what I made a note of was, they don't look like they came from an Abercrombie catalog, which I think is how, you know, I think it was the faculty actually, where there was a crossover with Abercrombie and Fincher, one of those companies.
Oh,
right,
God,
where the
yes,
actors from the film
ads.
Did ads in the catalog, and they were wearing the clothes from the company in the film. And This is not that film, which is to say that it feels very much more naturalistic than that, and I think, you know, that seems to be the general direction for these things. I think that, you know, young people now have their nose out for that kind of BS, that, you know, they're being sold a prepackaged product of what Hollywood thinks being in high school is like. And, you know, even when those movies still come out, I think of like 21 Jump Street, even Hollywood still has an appreciation that, you know, how we conventionally think of high school is not how high school is now.
Yeah. Yeah. I will say, despite the sort of heavy nature of this story, you know, and maybe at this time in a lot of people's lives, they prefer their entertainment to be something lighter and maybe something that to, you know, make them feel good or take them away. I was certainly crying at the end of this film, but I did have the odd thought that, oh, it's really kind of refreshing to be sad about something so completely normal. You know, something that would have made me sad 3 weeks ago and will probably make me sad, you know, 3 months from now, and is not at all related to, you know,
right.
What we're
it's
watching on the news every day right now.
And, you know, unfortunate fact of the world, people die all the time from, you know, not being able to see a way clear to having their mental health issues addressed, as sort of what happens at the end of this movie. We're kind of making it sound like it's a nonstop downer, and I feel that does it an injustice to the film, because I think there is, it's not like a laugh riot until tragedy happens. And I certainly, having had no background with the material at all, like I didn't know All the Bright Places was a YA novel, and I obviously hadn't read the novel, I hadn't seen any trailers for this, so I went into it as cold could be. But the tragedy is the idea that this will end in tragedy is there in the back of your head from like almost the jump. But at the same time, there is a wonderful journey that does have its bright moments. It has its challenging moments. I find that there are characters in the film who understand there may be tragedy coming, but that they have understood that they are there for the long haul. They are there to, you know, till the, I was going to say the bitter end, didn't necessarily have to be a bitter end, but there's an understanding that there could be a bitter end, and that they understand that they have a role to play in that, and to try and divert the expected ending, even though they may have a feeling that it's inevitable. But I don't find that sad necessarily. I didn't find the outcome, I mean, the outcome is definitely sad, but I found something very life-affirming that people were willing to keep trying to avert it, even though they understood that tragedy was coming.
Yeah, I would say the outcome is sad because over the course of the film, we come to love the characters as much as they love each other. And, you know, I did say, like, this is a love story, absolutely, and much of the film is very much like any other sort of teenage love story where, you know, two people who are maybe from different groups or different social class or different whatever, all of those things that sort of keep you apart from each other in a high school and in a teenage setting, when two of those people sort of meet for whatever circumstance and then come to care about each other and fall in love and do that. So that is definitely really the bulk of this film. But, you know, you are right when you talk about some of the other characters. You know, it is as much sort of a love story about them as well, too, and how they, you know, in some ways, some of these characters were way more mature than, you know, even many adults are. And maybe that's because of the circumstances they've had to, you know, they've already gone through. But to accept a person completely with all of their flaws and their strengths, and to understand that it's not my role to change another person, it's just my role to be there when they're ready to change, is a thing that I think this film made a lot of characters either already have that realization or come to it by the end, which is such an important thing, I think, for people to understand when they're dealing with anyone who has some sort of, well, I mean, not right. only mental health issues, just in general, but right. I really did like the, you know, the friends group and even the parents, actually. So Elle Fanning's character, has lost her sister. Her sister passed away, we learn right at the beginning. And I think it was so refreshing to see parents that are equally, like, so healthy about it, obviously mourning their own loss, but trying to help their daughter through this, which must be such a difficult thing to do. But it was a really nice, I really felt they did the parents really well. And while it was a very short movie, not very short, it was a regular length movie. There were so many other characters that were so nicely handled that, you know, if we had had more time with some of them, it wouldn't necessarily have been a problem.
I feel the movie is kind of a perfect length. I think there's a bit of a trend where a lot of movies now are kind of tipping over 2 hours. And I think that there's long been an understanding, like, you, in order to convey the seriousness of the situation, we have to drag this out. And, you know, I felt perfectly fine with the length, but I also agree that, I really like the parent characters a lot. I liked Alexandra Shipp as, Finch's sister, because she's basically holding the family up. The mother's basically absent, the dad is long gone, and so she's basically the maternal figure to Finch. And there's also an interesting spectrum to, you know, it shows that there is maybe more understanding, and maybe young people are feeling this particularly pointedly, that, you know, there's more understanding with young people now in terms of how, because of how they're being raised now, as we in terms of how we approach mental health things. But you also see a spectrum of reaction too. The best friend character you were talking about, you know, he has an interesting monologue where he talks about how he wishes he didn't have to deal with Finch's issues, but it's kind of his responsibility, or how he feels it's his responsibility as a friend to sort of be there when he comes out of it and to be that kind of anchor. And then you have Violet's ex-boyfriend, or, you know, someone in her orbit, someone who's in her social group. She goes to a party, basically to appease her parents. As you're saying, you know, they're trying to get her to get back to feeling normal. So she goes to this party, and this fella says to her, you know, how much longer are you going to be like this? Which, a complete void of understanding, as she's dealing with something fairly traumatic. And it's not just that her sister died in a car accident, it's that she was in the car when the accident occurred, which certainly amps up, you know, the feelings of survivor's guilt, and more than just typically being the surviving sister.
Yeah. I did really like that scene where she was sort of explaining the, you know, what actually happened. You know, so much of this movie is talking, you know, and just sort of talking or quiet moments between Violet and Finch. And I think it was just real, like, everything just looked really nice. I did actually look up where they did the filming of this, because I was surprised by how, I'm about to say something that actually is a point of the film. I was surprised by how ordinary everything looked, while also
Rob
looking
Gibbons,
so beautiful.
Did the cinematography, and he's worked with the director Brett Haley before. They did Hero, which is this, speaking of drama, a movie that stars Sam Elliott as sort of like a fading cowboy actor. Like, the film is really, really gorgeous. Like, there are so many scenes that they seem to, I don't know if it's a trick of like color correction or what it is, where it seems like they shot during the golden hour, which if people who you know the film lingo, golden hour is what they call like the last hour or so before sunset, where the light is fading and you get the really nice hues and you get the interesting colors, which you can fake pretty well with Photoshop and Adobe After Effects now, and, you know, even those commercial programs. But the film is very lovely to look at. It's very dreamlike in places, especially in those scenes where the two of them are kind of alone, and sort of revealing themselves to, you know, their stories to each other. That scene where she talks about the accident too, I felt was really powerful, because it feels like she's there in the car with Finch telling him, you know, it's kind of phrased that she is telling him the story, but it's also phrased at the same way that she's not looking at him as she's telling it. She's looking out the window of the car, and it seems like she's also kind of telling herself the story that.
Yeah. Almost as though she's never really admitted.
Yeah. That
to her
you
guilt,
know,
as you say,
she's telling herself her own origin. Like, what, how did I get here? And that was, really powerful. I'm not sure if that was the, if right after that, where there's the scene where she says, to Finch, it's nice to have a friend again.
Yes. Yeah. That's sort of, right before the really beautiful lush golden hour scene, where, you know, they pull over on the side of a road, just, you know, seemingly a small road through the middle of cornfields, the typical Indiana road,
yeah,
I guess.
It's about the small victories, right? And in that moment, it, you know, he's been poking and prodding her the whole time about getting, you know, getting back into living and getting back into life. And, you know, that it's a small moment, but in terms of, you know, where you are as with the characters and the themes and everything, it's as close as you get to a touchdown in this movie. It's the scene where the home team finally wins a game, and, you know, I'm thinking about The Way Back for some reason, but there you go.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, I really did like this film, and I, you know, we already talked about Elle Fanning, but I think Justice Smith is really great. You know, I think he was certainly the best part of the Pokemon movie, even though I did kind of enjoy the Pokemon movie probably more than I should have. But I have been really impressed with his work every time I see him. I just want to see more. So I look forward to seeing.
And he is not
all the things he does
Will
next.
Smith's son. He wants everyone to know that. I was doing research on the movie, and I came upon this article where in an interview, Justice Smith said he wants everyone to know that Will Smith is not his dad.
Well, and I wonder too, because he was in The Get Down, which is the first thing I saw him in, where Jaden Smith is also in that series, I guess.
Yeah, so you'd think seeing them side by side would give you ideas, but I mean, that's okay. It's interesting, and I saw somebody else note this. I think it was on the review on RogerEbert.com that it's an inversion of the typical manic pixie dream girl trope that, you know, you have the manic pixie dream guy for a change, and he does embody that really, really well. I've been off and on about Joseph Smith, and maybe because I've seen different things he's been in. I thought he was good in the Pokemon Detective Pikachu movie, but I've also have bad memories of him in Jurassic World, Fallen Kingdom, where he spends a lot of time running around screaming.
Is that his fault, though, or is that the movie?
Maybe he delivered what he was hired to do. I don't know, but I thought he was good here. One of the things I found about the film is that it, and I think it does this correctly, is that it doesn't try to pigeonhole Finch by saying like explicitly this is his problem, these are his issues, and I think that's that left a lot of work on Justice Smith's shoulders that he does end up carrying very well, that he has to portray the things that he can't say because the filmmakers and the writers don't want to, create something archetypal about, you know, bipolar disorder, which I think we're meant to gather is Finch's issue. But because they're being so cautious, that it leaves a lot to him to convey a lot just by acting, and he does rise to that occasion.
Mm-hmm. See, it's interesting to me that you felt it was bipolar disorder, because I felt it was something entirely different, which I think, and I did really like, as you say, the fact that they didn't really label, you know, what was wrong, to use a terrible term, you know, what his issue was. I saw so much more obsessive compulsive disorder to a degree that creates a lot of anxiety. But I think I think it doesn't really ultimately matter in this case, you know, and he had to find his own, Justice Smith had to find his own sort of reasoning for, you know, why his character would do the things he did. So.
Yes. And, I think that's to the benefit of the film, because a lot of people have sort of made the comparisons to 13 Reasons Why, which is another show on Netflix that deals with suicide, but deals with it. And I haven't watched the entire show, but it feels much more haphazard. It feels much more like edgy for the point of being edgy. And I did very much appreciate the restraint that Brett Haley brought. And I wanted to shout out to Liz Hannah, who co-wrote the screenplay, who is a really great writer, and I think she's a really great writer of female characters. I mean, obviously because she is female, but she did The Post, which I enjoy a lot, and not to say that it doesn't have its issues, but I did enjoy The Post. She also did The Long Shot, the Charlize Theron and Seth Rogen rom-com. So, you know, there was a lot of great character work with Charlize Theron's character in that movie. Seth Rogen at any speed, but the Charlize Theron character was wonderfully complex in that movie too. And you know, Liz Hannah, I think has a really great voice, and I think she used it very effectively in adapting the screenplay.
Mm-hmm. I think I might pick up the book this is based on and give it a read just to see, you know, what else didn't make it to the screen? Because as I mentioned, I did really enjoy the characters, all of them, and I feel like reading the book, I might get a little bit more of them, which I would be happy with.
And with that, we bring it full circle, because before we started recording and talking about all the bright places, we were talking about how you were trying to read books so that you could read the books that you have so you could get rid of them. And here we are with you talking about buying more books.
Yeah, because I have a problem. I like to purchase books. I do like to read them as well. I just don't do that nearly as much as I purchase them. So, yeah. It's one of the ways I maintain my personal mental health is by buying books.
All right. Well, maybe to wrap up, if anyone has any book recommendations for you, how can they find you on the internets?
Oh, I am on the internet at Cinn48, C-I-N-N-4-8, on pretty much all of the social medias. You can also go to Cinn48.com and find my personal podcast, which I've put out a few episodes lately since I've had more time on my hands, of 100% Candace, just in case this 50-50 deal isn't good enough for you. and you can also hear the podcast I do with The Bookshelf called The Village Podcast from The Bookshelf.
All right. Well, I wasn't sure what to expect when you recommended All the Bright Places. I am glad you recommended it, and I'm glad I watched it. And very life-affirming for these troubling times. So thank you for that, and I look forward to your next selection. Assuming this isn't all over by the time we come around back to you, but I have a feeling we will be Skype chatting about another movie in the near future.
Yep, and I will be here quietly, ready and waiting.
And that's it for this week's show. We hope you liked it, as always. And if you'd like to listen to it again, you can find it on our website, endcreditsradioshow.com. You can download it on the Guelph Politicast channel every Friday on Podbean, or through your favorite podcast app at Apple Podcasts, Stitcher, Google Play, and Spotify. You can find us on social media, on Facebook at End Credits Radio Show, or on Twitter at End Credits Radio. And I will be back on CFRU Thursday at 5 p.m. for News and Politics on Open Sources Guelph, and that was with my co-host, Scotty Hertz. Same as always, although also recorded remotely. You can find me on Twitter and Instagram as well, at Adam A. Donaldson, or you can find out my news and politics stuff on my website there, guelphpolitico.ca. And stay tuned for more great programming here on CFRU, 93.3 FM, CFRU.ca, Guelph Campus and Community Radio. We will be back, of course, next Wednesday at 2 p.m. for more self-isolated end credits, and we will see you then.